One of my absolute favorite hobbies is playing board games. Something that I've done, you know, growing up, something my brother and I used to share when we were at home by ourselves during the summertime. But I have a little bit of a confession to make to you. I'm not like this anymore, okay? I don't do this anymore, but I was a really bad cheater. And my brother can kind of confirm this. He can tell you he's always had to win, and so I would make up rules or I would leave out other rules in order so I could win. Well, then there was this game Jenga, and my brother really liked this game Jenga because it's really hard to cheat at Jenga. Okay, you can try, but a lot of times you just end up toppling the tower over on yourself. And so, you know, pride has always been an issue that I've always struggled with. You know, I just had to be the one that always won. And so we started playing this game Jenga a lot more. And Jenga is a lot like pride. It can tell us a lot about what pride really shows us. Pride is built one brick at a time, right? So if you build your foundation on pride, it can often look flawless. You know, it looks real nice and neat and clean. But with pride, you're always constantly trying to build yourself higher, right? Build yourself up more and more. And so with Jenga, you do that exact same thing. One brick at a time, you build up your tower higher and higher. But the higher that you get, the more you build yourself up, you begin to see things. You begin to notice that there are holes. What seemed so flawless before no longer is. And what ultimately is the outcome when you start to build your pride tower higher and higher? You eventually do the inevitable, right? Am I making anybody nervous? Eventually, your tower falls over, right? When you build your or you just keep knocking it over, a lot of times that's how our games of Jenga would end. One of us would just knock it over. That's how pride is, okay? When you build your foundation on pride, it begins to have flaws. It begins to show its holes, and eventually it topples over. And so our narrative today deals a lot with pride and our outcome of Jenga. You know, you build your tower of pride higher, and eventually it falls. It gives out under you, or you just knock it over anyway. Well, this is what happened to our nation of Edom in the book of Obadiah. Pride always has a way of building a false sense of security around each individual that's caught in its grasps. And so this was the case for the Edomites. Now, I'm going to read the entire book of Obadiah to you. And I know some of you are like, oh, gosh, he's going to read the whole book. Don't worry. It's the shortest book, or it's the shortest prophet in the Old Testament, one chapter, 21 verses, okay? But don't let its size fool you, because it's so powerful and it has a great message, okay? But to better understand Obadiah, we have to go all the way back to the book of Genesis. Because we have to kind of understand who the Edomites are, who our main characters are, and what their relationship is with Judah and Jerusalem. All right? Well, Isaac and Rebekah had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau was the huntsman, while Jacob was just kind of a plain tent dweller. Now, many of you already know the story, right? Esau was the firstborn, or came out first. So he had the birthright, or was going to receive the full inheritance from his father. But his brother Jacob tricked him. Now Genesis recounts that Esau was so furious that he planned on killing Jacob. So Jacob ran away. And for 20 years, they had this divide, this split. Now over time, the anger subsided with the help of God, and the two brothers did reunite. But the enmity between both groups of descendants remained. You know, both groups often fought, Israel and the Edomites. Now, Esau eventually settled in Edom, a mountainous region known for its red-colored sandstone. Now, these people later carved out the rock city of Petra, among others. And Esau and his descendants then became known as the Edomites and built their cities high in the rugged mountains overlooking the Arabah. The cities built were strong fortresses, 5,000 feet elevation, which overlooked and threatened anybody around them. So now you know just a little bit about who the Edomites were, descendants of Esau. But there's more to the story than that. Okay, Obadiah opens, and it takes place during the time of the Babylonian captivity of Judah, when they came and ransacked and destroyed Jerusalem, which was exactly what God had said would happen. This is a key story in which Daniel and his buddies Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego play a critical role as well. Now, God's people had been warned and warned and warned so many times that they probably just lost count by many prophets over the days that this was coming for them. Destruction was coming. And our buddies, the Edomites, also played a major role in this destruction. But God also promised retribution against those who aided him and in his destruction of Judah. So Obadiah, the prophet, then received a message from God and a warning for the Edomites, as well as a promise for the Jerusalemites. The Edomites had done something horrible against Judah and Jerusalem. Remember, they're all kind of descendants. They're all kind of family in a way. But instead of coming to the aid of Jerusalem during the Babylonian captivity, they instead took part in the raid. They sided with their foreign invaders and took advantage of Israel's misfortunes. So let's just read a little bit of what Obadiah has to say. This is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, "Rise up, let's go against her for battle." God is recruiting all the nations around Edom to rise up against Edom. Those ones that they kind of probably thought were their allies, the ones that they helped ransack and raid Jerusalem and Judah, are now going to be turning against them. "See, I will make you small among the nations. You will be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you." There's that pride issue starting to rear its head. "You who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home high on the heights, you who say to yourself, 'Who can bring me down to the ground?' Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down," declares the Lord. God is calling out the Edomites. Now remember, we said they built their homes high in the mountains, okay? They probably thought, "Hey, we're way up here. Nobody can touch us." These are the ones who are famous for building and carving out cities in the sandstone. A city known as Petra, which was made famous in the Indiana Jones movies, which kind of looks a little bit like this. You can kind of see there's the city carved in there, but you're looking through a narrow passage, okay? Narrow passages were so easy to defend. They weren't worried. They were not worried about any oncoming invaders, because they were well protected. But God is saying, "You know what? You think you're so high and you're so mighty and you're arrogant and your pride. Well, I'm going to bring you down. You think you can protect yourself here, but you can't. If thieves came to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what a disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave just a few grapes? But oh, how Esau will be ransacked." Esau, just another name for Edom, for the descendants. "His hidden treasures will be pillaged. All of your allies will force you to the border, and your friends who will deceive you and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it." Okay, those surrounding nations around them, who once were probably their allies, are now going to be turning against little Edom. "Those of understanding the mountains of Esau, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom? Your warriors, Teman, will be terrified, and everyone on Esau's mountain will be cut down in the slaughter. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever." God is promising a destruction on Edom for what they did against Judah and Jerusalem. "On that day, you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered the gates and cast lots for Jerusalem. You were like one of them." In these following verses, we kind of see exactly what they did against Judah and Jerusalem. God is like, "I'm calling you out for every single thing that you did. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. You should not march to the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of trouble. They didn't do a lot of nice things. These were not good things, and God was kind of calling him out for it. What's interesting about these verses is that Obadiah said, you should not, you should not, you should not. You know, God is issuing a warning through Obadiah. He's saying, hey, the Edomites still have a chance at reconciliation. But the fact of the matter is, they're not going to listen to it. They're going to do every single one of these things, and that's exactly what they do. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. Just as you drank on my holy hill, so all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and drink and be as if they had never been. But on Mount Zion will be deliverance. It will be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. Jacob will be a fire and Joseph a flame. Esau will be stubble, and they will set him on fire and destroy him. In other words, this reunited Israel will defeat Edom. There will be no survivors from Esau. The Lord has spoken. People from the Negev will occupy the mountains of Esau. And people from the foothills will possess the land of the Philistines. They will occupy the fields of Ephraim and Samaria. And Benjamin will possess Gilead. This company of Israelite exiles who are in Canaan will possess the land as far as Zarephath. The exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sepharad will possess the towns of the Negev. And deliverers or saviors will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau. And the kingdom will be the Lord's. Now, I read a ton to you, and this whole story might not be fully grasped. It wasn't always easy for me to fully grasp the story. But when I was in college, when I was in seminary, I had a professor. And it was during my Old Testament interpretation class. We were kind of combing through the Old Testament prophets. And we just happened to cross Obadiah. And he goes, oh, I've got a great story for you. If you read this one, it will sum up and will make Obadiah so much more clear. It will just make sense. And so I want to share that story with you today. That story comes from the great literary theologian, Dr. Seuss. Okay, I'm just kidding. He's not a theologian, but he had some really great morality tales. And so my professor pointed out this book called Yertle the Turtle. And so I want to read it to you, and you can follow along with the pictures up on the screen. Yertle the Turtle. On the faraway island of Salamisand, Yertle the Turtle was king of the pond. A nice little pond. It was clean. It was neat. The water was warm. There was plenty to eat. The turtle had everything turtles might need, and they were all happy, quite happy indeed. They were, until Yertle, the king of them all, decided the kingdom he ruled was too small. I'm the ruler, said Yertle, of all that I see, but I don't see enough. That's the trouble with me. With this stone for a throne, I look down on my pond, but I cannot look down on the places beyond. It ought to be higher, he said with a frown. If I could sit high, how much greater I'd be. What a king, I'd be ruler of all that I see. So Yertle the Turtle King lifted his hand, and Yertle the Turtle King gave a command. He ordered 9 turtles to swim to his stone, and using these turtles, he built a new throne. He made each turtle stand on another one's back, and he piled them up in a 9 turtle stack. And then Yertle climbed up, he sat on the pile. What a wonderful view he could see for a mile. All mine, Yertle cried. Oh, the things I now rule. I'm king of a cow. I'm king of a mule. I'm king of a house. And what's more beyond that, I'm king of a blueberry bush and a cat. I'm Yertle the Turtle. Oh, marvelous me. For I am the ruler of all that I see. And all through that morning, he sat up there high, saying over and over, a great king am I. Until long about noon, then he heard a faint sigh. What's that? Snapped the king. And he looked down the stack, and he saw at the bottom a turtle named Mac. Just a part of his throne, and this was plain little turtle, looked up and he said, beg your pardon, King Yertle, I have pains in my back, in my shoulders and knees. How long must we stand here? Oh, Majesty, please. Silence, the king of the turtles barked back. I'm king, and you're only a turtle named Mac. You stay in your place while I sit here and rule. I'm king of a cow, and I'm king of a mule. I'm king of a house and a bush and a cat, but that isn't all. I'll do better than that. My throne shall be higher, his royal voice thundered. So pile up more turtles. I want about 200. Turtles, more turtles, he bellowed and brayed, and the turtles went down in the pond, were afraid. They trembled, they shook, but they came, they obeyed. From all over the pond they came swimming by dozens, whole families of turtles with uncles and cousins. And all of them stepped on the head of poor Mac. One after another they climbed up the stack. Then Yurl the turtle was perched up so high he could see 40 miles from his throne in the sky. Hooray, shouted Yurtle, I'm king of the trees, I'm king of the birds, I'm king of the bees, I'm king of the butterflies, king of the air. Ah, me, what a throne, what a wonderful chair. I'm Yurtle the turtle, oh marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all that I see. Then again from below in the great heavy stack came a groan from that plain little turtle named Mac. Your Majesty, please, I don't like to complain, but down here below we're feeling great pain. I know up on top you're seeing great sights, but down at the bottom we too should have rights. We turtles can't stand it. Our shells will all crack. Besides, we need food. We're starving, groaned Mac. You hush up your mouth, howled the mighty King Yurtle. You've no right to talk to the world's highest turtle. I rule from the clouds over land, over sea. There's nothing, no nothing, that's higher than me. But while he was shouting, he saw with surprise that the moon of the evening was starting to rise. Up over his head in the darkening skies, what's that? Snorted Yurtle. Say, what is that thing that dares to be higher than Yurtle the king? I shall not allow it. I'll go higher still. I'll build my throne higher. I can and I will. I'll call some more turtles. I'll stack them to heaven. I need about 5,607. But as Yurtle the turtle king lifted his hand and started to order and give the command, that plain little turtle below in the stack, that plain little turtle whose name was just Mac, decided he'd taken enough and he had. And that plain little lad got a little bit mad. And that plain little Mac did a plain little thing. He burped, and his burp shook the throne of the king. And Yurtle the turtle, the king of the trees, the king of the air and the birds and the bees, the king of a house and a cow and a mule, well, that was the end of the turtle king's rule. For Yurtle the king of Salamisan fell off his high throne and fell plunk in the pond. And today the great Yurtle, that marvelous he, is king of the mud. That's all that he can see. And the turtles, of course, all the turtles are free as turtles, and maybe all creatures should be. Yurtle the turtle, doesn't that just sum up the book of Obadiah so nicely? You see, Yurtle was just like the Edomites. He was prideful, he was arrogant, and he sought to make his name great, just as the little nation of Edom thought they were so high and mighty in their mountain stronghold. But Obadiah warned Edom. He said, hey, you think you're so high and you're so mighty and you're protected? Well, I'm going to bring you down. Just like little Mac said, hey, you're not really thinking about all these turtles underneath you. Our shells are starting to crack. We need food. And what kind of happened to Edom and Yurtle? Well, they both fell, didn't they? And in the end, all the turtles were free. And so are all of us. This was God's warning to the little arrogant nation who are shaking their fists at him and spitting on his people that they're headed for destruction. And so what happened? The Edomites fell. Yurtle fell and ended up in the mud. Now there are some amazing things that we can garner and some questions that we can ask ourselves and answer from God's warning through Obadiah to the Edomites. And so these are kind of points, questions for you. I'd like you to, just kind of, if you want to, you can jot these down or just try to remember them. And the first question is this. The first point is this. Who is your true enemy? Who is your true enemy? So since we have some different perspectives here in Obadiah, we must look at it from a few different angles. Judah, just God's people, Judah, thought that they would probably have an ally in their kind of family members, Edom, right? But what happened? Edom turned against poor Judah. And so allies became enemies, an enemy they couldn't detect. In the opposite angle, we think a little bit about Edom, all right? They joined in these other nations as they attacked and destroyed Jerusalem. But even they couldn't detect the fact that all those nations around them were not their allies. God was going to use them to destroy Edom. God was telling them that the ones that they thought were going to help them would ultimately bring destruction on them. So whether you look from the perspective of the Edomites or Judah, we must understand that as Christians, sometimes it's difficult and it's hard to detect who our true enemy is. But we all have one. All of us Christians have a common enemy. Satan uses our weaknesses against us. For Judah, it was their disobedience. For the Edomites, it was their arrogance, it was their pride, and there was their betrayal. But that's not unlike many of us today, right? We all have our moments of disobedience to God, our moments of pride, of arrogance, and even betrayal. And the enemy, our true enemy, will use them all against us until we've built ourselves up, just like Jenga or the Edomites, and eventually we fall and we crumble. And where do we often fall when that happens? We fall into despair. We fall into depression. Or we jump to other areas to help cope with our disobedience. But as Christians and disciples, we're to build each other up and come to the aid of our friends and our neighbors as we seek to honor God and battle our true enemy. So who is your true enemy? We know who he is. But that brings us to question number two. Point number two, if you will. Who is your Obadiah? Who's your Obadiah? Obadiah was issuing a warning to the Edomites. Stop what you're doing, or what you're going to do, or you're going to be destroyed in the exact same manner. Mac the Turtle warned Yertle that the shells would break or give out, but he still just kept climbing higher and higher. He couldn't see past his pride and his arrogance. Now, we're in a sermon series called Friends for the Journey, and this is just as applicable here. Obadiah literally means one who serves Yahweh or God. Now, we all have friends, especially individuals that we look up to or that we even think very highly of. And these people are often our voices of reason who give us guidance and wisdom to navigate difficult roads in our lives. And often, there are individuals who humbly serve the Lord. There are Obadiahs. And we all need someone whom we greatly respect to remind us and call us out when our arrogance or our pride begin to build. Now, I'm a champion for encouraging individuals to seek an accountability partner. Someone you can confide in, someone you can trust to express your shortcomings to. Someone who will, as the term applies, hold you accountable for your actions. We all need them. So I encourage you, if you don't already have one, find your Obadiah. Find that one who is going to help hold you accountable, but who is also going to strengthen and build you up and help you on your road to humility. And finally, and this is the most important question, the most important point, who is your rescuer? Who is your rescuer? Who could rescue the Edomites from the coming destruction? No one. They had the opportunity to turn things around, but they chose disobedience. Who could rescue God's people from destruction? No one. They too had the opportunity for obedience, but they were not. Obadiah, at the end of the book, gives some encouragement and reassurance to the Jerusalemites who have seen the destruction of their city and nation as God had promised. They had lost their land. They had lost their wealth. They had lost their freedom. Their outlook on life seemed just a little bleak, but God offered them just a little glimpse of hope. It says in verse 21, "Saviors will go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's." God is promising that those appointed by him to deliver the people will also bring just governance to them. The Lord has and always will be the king over all nations. But here the prophet is promising something in the future. He's showing the definitive manifestation of God's kingly rule on Mount Zion or Jerusalem. So basically this points to the redemptive reign that started in the ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus our Savior. But what does that mean? What does that mean for the Israelites? What does that mean for us? It means that for them, it means that God is in charge and his people are going to be restored through Jesus. But for us, it means something even better. You see, pride, arrogance, betrayal, sin have ultimately transformed us into God's enemies. I mean, Paul reminds us in Romans that the consequences of our sin is death. Okay, in our sin, we're on a downward spiral. But God decided to do something to save us from ourselves. And this is, I want you to grasp this. This is so important. God has given us, all of us, a path out of arrogance, a path out of pride, a path out of sin, in a humble intimacy with him through Jesus Christ. Okay, the destruction that we deserve because of our sin was instead heaped upon him at the cross. Because of Jesus' obedience, we have a rescuer. So we can answer that question, who is our rescuer? Because we know who it is. It's Jesus. Pastor and author Rick Lawrence had this to say about Obadiah. Obadiah is a raw, brutal snapshot of where our lives would be headed if not for the promise of rescue offered to us by Jesus. Sure, we still yap and lunge and threaten because truthfully, we're all so insecure in ourselves. But Jesus transforms our ugly into something beautiful. So who is your rescuer? Jesus is our rescuer. So I have a challenge for you in this coming week. Two things. One, if you don't already have an accountability partner, I strongly recommend one for you. You look around, there's all kinds of people here who are godly people who serve and follow the Lord, and they're going to help you. They're going to guide you. Who is someone you can find to confide in, to express your shortcomings to, who's going to point you in the right directions? Zach, you've been struggling with this, and I know you're telling me about these things. Here's some scripture for you to read. Here's a good path to go down to. Here's some people that you can talk to. Find your Obadiah, that person who's going to encourage you, who's going to build you up, but ultimately help you be held accountable for your actions. Someone who's going to point you towards the direction of humility. And two, if you have the opportunity, I would really challenge you to do an act of humility this week. And that can be something as simple as, you know, putting somebody else before yourselves, doing something nice for someone. Or maybe it could be putting God before yourselves. You know that prayer that you've been meaning to say to God or ask God or talk to God about? Take the opportunity, take that time to say it. Or maybe there's that scripture you know you've been needing to read, but your own selfishness keeps you from doing it because you'd rather do other things. Put that selfishness aside, put that pride aside, and go to God and say, you know what, I need to read these scriptures. This is that opportunity for us to do an act of humility. But maybe you're here today and you're saying to yourself, I want that relationship with Jesus. I'm tired of building up myself a tower of pride because I know that eventually it's going to end up with all kinds of holes and it's going to topple over. I want to build my foundation on Jesus, on humility. And if that's you today, I encourage you to come forward. And I'd love to talk to you later on about what it means to make that decision to follow Jesus Christ. Or maybe you're here today and you say, you just look around, you say, I love what's going on here at Oldville Christian Church. These are people that I can go to for guidance and for help. I can find my Obadiah here. And I encourage you to come forward, and we'd love to make you a part of Oldville Christian Church. If you have a decision to make for Jesus, I encourage you to do so as we stand and we sing our song of invitation.